2014 will be an important year in the destiny of Great Britain. A referendum on the independence of Scotland, once considered a nationalist pipe dream, is now a certainty. If the people of Scotland vote yes, the implications will reverberate through Britain and beyond. The union between Scotland and England, the basis for the Union Jack and the United Kingdom, will no longer exist.
Symbolically, it will have huge implications. The end of the Union Jack, but also the perception of Great Britain.
Britain's armed forces will be divided, and its nuclear weapons, now housed at a submarine base in Scotland, will be removed.
We want nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, and we want that abomination out of our waters.
The different nations of the islands of Britain may go their separate ways.
Basically, the United Kingdom is a fiction. It is the English state with Celtic appendages, Scotland, Wales, and the bit of Ireland that's still inside the United Kingdom.
The concept of Britain would become more like we understand the concept of Scandinavia to be. Within Britain, which is a single landmass, there will be more than one independent country.
Long before the birth of nation states, a wall was constructed, which marked the northern boundary of the Roman Empire. Building began in the year 122, when Emperor Hadrian visited Britain. It was the most heavily fortified border in the empire.
The Romans built these defences because their armies couldn't quell the unruly people who lived in what is now Scotland. But nor did they have the will. England had gold and copper, and the land to the north seemed too barren and mountainous to colonise. The lasting legacy of Roman Britain is a symbolic barrier that has forever separated the people of what is now Scotland from England.
Scotland has its own very distinct history and culture, which goes back well before the construction of Hadrian's Wall. But up until only 300 years ago, Scotland was an independent country with its own parliament, its own legal system, its own educational system.
But from the 14th century, Scotland's independence was being challenged by its powerful neighbour to the south. After a series of battles, England's King Edward II came to Scotland in the summer of 1314 to destroy the Scottish army and end resistance to English rule. He brought 3,000 cavalry and 20,000 footmen from England. It was at least double the size of the army of the Scottish King, Robert the Bruce. According to legend, shortly before the Battle of Bannockburn, Robert was spotted by an English knight who thundered towards him with his lance drawn. Robert had no armour and held only a battle axe, but he stood his ground and hit the knight so hard with his axe that he killed him instantly.
The defeat of the English army was absolute. King Edward II fled across the border back to England. His army tried to flee across there. There was a river. Apparently, many of his soldiers died. The river ran red with blood. The victory established Robert the Bruce as a Scottish nationalist hero and guaranteed the nation's independence, at least for several centuries.
Films that reenact the Battle of Bannockburn are popular in Scotland and often shown in schools.
The long wars of independence established that the ordinary people of Scotland owed no fealty to England's king. This determination was made explicit in the Declaration of Arbroath, drawn up 6 years later in 1320.
It is on the 700th anniversary of Robert the Bruce's victory that the referendum on independence will take place, and nationalists will once more invoke the Declaration of Arbroath.
It is the shortest paragraph in the Declaration, however, which is the most significant, and which still thunders down the centuries. For so long as 100 men remain alive, we shall never, under any condition, submit to the domination of the English.
The Declaration ended with words that have inspired a belief in Scottish independence ever since.
It's entered into, I think, the Scottish psyche and the Scottish the Scottish mentality as being a very important statement of self-determination of Scotland as a country.
Over the coming centuries, the English would not give up their wish to conquer Scotland. Border towns like Berwick became central to repeated clashes between the kingdoms of England and Scotland. The last time it changed hands was when England reconquered Berwick in 1482. Berwick lies 4 miles from the border with Scotland, but its residents are unsure of their national loyalty.
They asked the people of Berwick, would they like to be part of Scotland, because they observed the way that Scotland was better governed than it was in the northeast of England. And they voted by quite a significant margin to opt to go back into Scotland.
There are no proposals to annex it or do anything else in independent Scotland. It might be interesting if the people of Berwick want to have a plebiscite and they decide they would wish to be part of an independent Scotland rather than remain in the UK. They could petition the rest of the UK government for that, and I'm sure the Scottish government would be more than happy to talk with the government in London and see if the border can be changed.
In 1603, Queen Elizabeth of England had died without an heir, and the rulers of both countries made a deal to lay down their arms. They agreed to form Great Britain under Scotland's King James VI. The Union Jack was formed by merging the Scottish flag, the saltire, with the flag of England. A century later, an act of union disbanded the Scottish Parliament and brought MPs from north of the border to Westminster.
The way in which that union was created in the first place was extremely anti-democratic and against the popular will of people in Scotland. And it was really a union undertaken by the privileged classes at that time for their own particular benefit.
The Scottish gentry were basically bribed, or some of them accepted bribes, to sign the Act of Union.
To quote Robert Burns, the people that signed away Scotland into the Union were a parcel of rogues.
And for England, there was another motive. The union with Scotland allowed the English to begin building an empire.
For the English Empire to be secure, it had already conquered Wales. Wales had already been absorbed quite very cleverly indeed. Scotland had been an instrument of French foreign policy. And France and England were always at war with each other. And so Scotland was used time after time to rattle the English cage. England, from a foreign policy point of view, had to absorb us. Did so in 1707, and that was everything locked up perfectly. From there, they could expand because there was no threat, as it were, to the homeland security.
Scotland benefited from its role in the empire. Its cities became centres of learning, and they grew in wealth from riches taken from imperial lands.
In this period, we're talking about Scotland's the second richest nation on earth. It had undergone a massive and very, very fast industrialisation.
Joining that empire enabled the Scottish industry, the shipbuilding industry, the steel industry and the coal industry, and the Scottish upper middle class, the managerial class, to actually make their way in this wider empire. But of course, times have changed. There aren't the opportunities now.
The industries that propelled Scotland's economic growth have now declined. The River Clyde was once the world's preeminent shipbuilding centre, with 40 firms making ocean liners and battleships. By the 1960s, shipbuilding on the Clyde had become uneconomic. Jim Sillars was a former trades union official who became a Labour MP.
It was 2 years' experience of being a Member of Parliament at Westminster that converted me to the idea that Scotland had to do something very, very different in its constitutional relationship with England. And I began to realise that if you look at state interests, then the English state interest would always predominate and the Scottish state interest would be in a backwater. And so I started a 10-year journey to the point where I realised this is a nonsense, we really need to be independent in order to do things in our own way in relation to our own needs.
In the 1980s, with Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister, the British government challenged the welfare state and introduced free market capitalism. Shipbuilding, like much of Scotland's industry, was privatised. The home counties of England began to appear like a different country.
There is a sense in Scotland that the kind of culture, political culture, and even indeed to some extent social culture, which is developing in the home counties, is slightly alien to us. If anything, that could be the most deep-seated Scottish perception about possible separation, that we're no longer on the same track.
Scotland has been profoundly influenced by the Industrial Revolution and the socialism that grew out of that as a reaction to what happened to working class people. I mean, when Mrs. Thatcher, for example, was lionised in England, she was detested up here. And one of the great problems of the Tory party in Scotland is that they're toxic because they were associated with Margaret Thatcher.
When you talk about the biggest difference between Scotland and the South East or the rest of England is our political culture. This place in England now votes Conservative. It's a Conservative-led government here at Westminster. We've got one Conservative Member of Parliament in Scotland. There's more giant pandas in Edinburgh Zoo than there are Conservative Members of Parliament. So there obviously is a very unique and distinct culture in Scotland, which is very different to what we observe down here in the South East of England.
Scotland has always been traditionally more supportive of the state because it lost all its major industries, and the state really post-1945 was the one that kept things alive. There might be the perception that what the current government is doing is not all that much different from Thatcherism, which was the propellant for the Scottish Parliament. If you had to take the 1980s and all that meant for up here out of the equation, I think it's highly unlikely there would be a Holyrood Parliament today.
The new Scottish Parliament was built in the Holyrood Park district of Edinburgh. The Labour government in London gave politicians in Scotland control over matters such as health and education policy. But rather than satisfy the aspirations of the Scottish people, Labour's devolution settlement unleashed a fresh appetite for independence. The Scottish Nationalist Party won a majority in the Assembly in 2011 and promised a referendum on independence.
Since we've had the Scottish Parliament, you know, like the idea of Scottishness has increased quite dramatically. I think if you were to ask Scottish people even 20 years ago, like to state their nationality, you would probably find a majority would have said British. Nowadays, very few people in Scotland would actually define themselves as such. If you ask them their nationality, they would say Scottish.
But the independence of Scotland will have momentous implications for the rest of what is now the United Kingdom. One of the battles will be over how to divide the UK's national debt and what to do with the oil lying off the shores of Scotland.
The oil factor will be very important because that could have very significant effects.
Damage the English economy?
Yes, it could have very significant effects on the Treasury. Current scientific estimates believe that North Sea oil will go on for another 60 years. So it's become deeply political relevant again. It's not something which is a dying resource.
With higher unemployment and a greater dependence on welfare, some research in England has claimed that its taxpayers are subsidising Scotland by almost £25 billion. But the two sides cannot agree on the numbers.
When North Sea oil was discovered, unlike Norway, which said, oh, that's our oil, they actually created a separate account in the London Treasury, not in the Scottish account, but in a North Sea account, so that we could not count the North Sea oil into Scottish accounts when we were arguing whether we were subsidised or not. Very peculiar. The fish that swim around in the North Sea and land in Scotland, they're in the Scottish account. The oil that comes through the fish in lands in Scotland from the North Sea. No, no, no. That's a separate account. So the figures have been fiddled for a considerable period of time.
My own speculation is the first years will be difficult. But if the market opportunities for Scotland, i.e. existing markets, in 5 or 10 years' time start to pick up after the current horrors that we're going through at the moment, with the North Sea oil factor, and also, Scotland is making heavy investment in renewables in an attempt to become the renewable capital of the world. Maybe in 10 to 15 years' time, it will look like Norway, with a significantly higher standard of life than the rest of the UK.
If Norway, which is roughly the same amount of oil as us, and a smaller population than us, can be viable with fishing and oil, and we've got more resources than Norway in terms of agriculture, by the way, then I don't see any reason whatsoever why Scotland cannot not only be viable, but be a far better economic unit than it is under the Union at the present time.
The country that we most enviously look at when it comes to North Sea oil is Norway, who invested into an oil fund. And that oil fund is now more prosperous than its GDP itself. And that's what Scotland should have had. Now, we didn't benefit from the first half to the first two-thirds of oil, but let's see if we can make sure that North Sea oil could work for Scotland as we go forward. We could benefit, like Norway do, from a fund based on our natural resources.
An independent Scotland may forge closer trading and diplomatic links with nations to the east, rather than to what's left of the United Kingdom.
There's some evidence that the Scottish government has been attempting to make seductive advances, if you like, to the Scandinavian countries. This, to me as an historian, is fascinating, because in the medieval and early modern periods, right through until the 40 to 50 years before the Union of 1707, the Scottish migration, trade, intellectual and religious axis bent towards Europe. Scotland has traditionally been more associated with Europe, at least down to the 18th century when it became Atlanticist and imperial. Is that old bond going to be renewed?
As Scotland's bond with the rest of Britain is severed, organisations such as the BBC will have an uncertain future. While it will retain the pound as its currency, at least initially, Scotland will adopt different policies regarding immigration.
We have an immigration policy for the United Kingdom, quite rightly, which suits the majority, the people who live in the southeast of England. It's overheating, it's overcooking. In Scotland, we've got structural depopulation. So, like, we're being served an immigration policy that's designed and determined for the majority here in the southeast of England, which isn't appropriate or applicable to Scotland. And that's one of the reasons why we need to be in control of these sort of issues.
The most contentious issues that could spark a serious rift between the London government and Scotland surround Britain's defence policy. The British Army was formed 3 centuries ago with a merger of the Scottish and English armed forces. So what will happen to Scottish citizens who find themselves serving in the British military?
They'll have the choice. They could decide to continue to serve in the UK armed forces, or they could decide to come and join a Scottish Defence Force. That'll be their choice.
The plan is to use the Scottish regiments, the Royal Regiment of Scotland, all 6 battalions, as the core of our Scottish Defence Force, which of course would be, you know, the equivalent size probably of some of the smaller countries in Europe.
An even greater problem could arise over the Faslane naval base on the west coast of Scotland, the site of Britain's nuclear weapons.
When the British state got its so-called independent nuclear deterrent from the United States, it located it in the west of Scotland. It didn't locate it any other place. We've objected to that ever since, and so a Scottish foreign policy would ultimately see the Trident nuclear missile system leave Scotland.
We really don't want them in an independent Scotland, and therefore we wouldn't make the facilities available for them or for third parties such as NATO to station nuclear subs and nuclear weapons on Scottish soil. There's a broad consensus in Scotland that we believe in having a future where the defence of our country is not dependent upon nuclear annihilation.
At the end of the day, that's a clear thing for Scotland. We want nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, and we want that abomination out of our waters.
the removal of nuclear weapons from Scotland will reflect a much wider change in foreign policy.
If there had been an independent Scottish government controlling the Scottish Armed Services, I don't think Scottish troops would have been deployed to support the American initiatives in Iraq and in other places around the world.
Everybody get out of here!
Scots were so utterly opposed to the stupidity of that. And that's a very good example of where the foreign policy would have been very, very different.
And one thing that we would never, ever do in Scotland would be sending our young men to an illegal war that was determined here at Westminster. That just wouldn't happen.
Being a small nation, there would be a bit more respect for other emergent nations and cultures and, you know, a desire to talk to people and try and resolve differences in that fashion rather than to use brute force and armed strength.
The global impact of Scottish independence could reach the United Nations. If Scotland had a seat, there would be questions concerning the right of what remains of the UK to retain its place on the UN Security Council.
A question mark would arise as to whether the England would continue to hold a permanent position on the Security Council. However, that's resolved is up to the United Nations and up to the new English government that will control most of Britain after Scottish independence.
We would never have some of these foreign pretensions that the UK has just now, seats in Security Councils, United Nations, mean nothing to the people of Scotland, and it's something that we exert no value to whatsoever.
It is so decided.
London still has the imperial mind. Its position on as a veto-wielding power on the Security Council is very, very important to that establishment down there. I mean, if you took that away, then the British Foreign Secretary would be no more important than the Belgian Foreign Secretary, and that'd be a trauma beyond traumas for them down there.
The days of a powerful United Kingdom have gone, and they're not going to come back. And like I think in Scotland, we've accepted that and got used to it, and we want a different type of model for our foreign footprint as we go forward.
In the corridors of Westminster, there is much debate about the name of the state that will be left after Scotland's independence, made up of Wales, England and Northern Ireland.
There's a number of options. Wengland, for example, is one that could be used.
Wengland, yeah. Wenger Ireland.
Might be a good opportunity to try and drop the word great from the title of the islands, you know, and that might endear us rather more to our neighbours elsewhere in the world.
It can't be called Great Britain. It could be called Little Britain.
The most common term I've used to date is the United Kingdom of England, Wales and Northern Ireland.
The convulsions caused by a yes vote will force the remaining Celtic nations in Britain to consider their union with England. In Northern Ireland, the government's peace agreement with the IRA allows its citizens to form a united Ireland, should the majority want it. Wales is also seeking greater self-governance on a road that could lead to its independence.
Britain, as we know it, is over. The nature of the British state is rapidly changing. And if they vote for independence, the state would cease to exist in its current format. And as far as Wales is concerned, we need to be ready for those eventualities and be prepared for the fundamental realignment that will happen.
The momentous implications of Scotland's independence are only slowly being understood here in London. There is growing unease, in some cases even panic, inside the English establishment. London will suffer a colossal blow to its prestige, losing about a third of the territory it now governs. The whole political class has united in a determined effort to prevent a yes vote.
We are stronger together and weaker apart. Does the Prime Minister agree with me about the shared benefits to us all of Scotland's part in the United Kingdom?
It is time to speak out, whatever the consequences, because something very special is in danger. The ties that bind us in the place that we call home. It's about our history, our values, our shared identity, and our joint place in the world. All of this is why this Prime Minister and this party is going to fight for the United Kingdom with everything we've got.
They just simply cannot understand how anyone would not want to have the benefit of their wonderful governments. They're blind to someone saying, look, pal, we can actually do this differently.
If history is made in 2014 and Scotland leaves the United Kingdom, the identities of the various peoples of the British Isles will forever change.
One of the things you've got to reflect upon is the dissolution of Britishness, the disappearance of Scotland, even though Scotland is a 9 to 10% of the population of GB, that symbolically it will have huge implications.
The end of the Union Jack.
Exactly, the end of the Union Jack, but also the perception of Great Britain. We'll be right back.